Morning. May it please the court. Fred Arnson on behalf of appellant Lewis Mallow. This is appeal from Mr. Mallow's post-conviction action concerning his claims that his attorneys were ineffective in failing to raise or address issues concerning vague and nonspecific verdict directors in a multiple count case. He was charged with three counts for alleged sexual contact with CBK, two child molestation charges, and one statutory sodomy charge. On the molestation charges, the allegations were identical, that he touched her genitals with no other specificity. And then in the verdict directors, they were identical, just requiring the jurors to find that he touched CBK's genitals without making any distinction between various incidents that had been indicated in the evidence, particularly in CBK's prior statement.
No objection was made at trial? No objection was made to that at trial?
To the instructions, no.
And so your argument is it was unreasonable trial strategy not to object?
Correct. Well, there were claims made against both a trial counsel and appellate counsel, and so the claim would be that the trial counsel was ineffective for not objecting and requiring specificity and differentiation in the verdict directors. And then appellate counsel, even assuming that it was not preserved below, that appellate counsel was ineffective for not raising it on appeal. Admittedly, the evidence, particularly with respect to the trial counsel's strategy at his post-conviction cases, was lacking. But I do think there is some authority that the court can consider whether there's any conceivable reason why a trial attorney would not object to that and find the trial attorney was ineffective on that basis. Based on CBA's...
What about the strategy that it might encourage a disagreement amongst the jurors such that some may actually six one way, six another? I mean, I understand the Solis Garcia case about unanimous verdict, but couldn't that play into the advantage of the defendant in certain cases?
I think,
in other words, if it's not unanimous, it's not guilty. It's almost encouraging discussion about a compromise verdict in a way.
I don't really. I mean, I understand that. You know, I mean, that was the state's argument.
It'd be a complicated strategy, but nonetheless.
And I don't understand that, because the way it is now, the jurors could have disagreed about it and still convicted him. I mean, we have no indication. But if you
convicted him of one,
what?
Convicted him of one, but not two.
Right. So
there'd be no incentive to sit there with a 10-2.
Right. But let's say you ask them to specifically consider each incident. Okay, and half say, or you know, a third say one incident, a third another, and a third the third. In that case, you would possibly have they still can only convict. I mean, they can't convict them of anything. In which case,
you're saying
it would
you
be want
to focus them on making sure they agree on the same incident, because otherwise. Did anything tell them it had to be the same incident under the same count?
No, and you know, it's not a case like there are some times where they're not specific, but still an argument. You know, that the attorney, the state will address it. I've seen this in child pornography cases. Well, you know, this image goes to count one, not addressed. Matter of fact, the argument by the state to the juror was kind of to the contrary. It's like, well, you know, she testified that there were three incidents. We charged him with two. You picked the two.
So if you get the relief that you're requesting, then the state would be able to recharge all three?
I don't believe so.
How would we know which one they were acquitted on?
That's the problem. I mean,
well, any more than we know which one they were convicted on.
Right.
So if you get the relief you requested, why wouldn't the state be entitled to charge all three?
Well, because he's acquitted of something. But
how do we know?
Well, that's the problem. I mean, you know, does the state get the benefit of this situation that he's had jeopardy attached, he's been acquitted of one charge, and I think they can't charge him with all three. They can maybe get him with one because they clearly found he can only commit one act. But even with the one act, how do we know which conduct he committed? He acquitted of him of.
So
we don't know.
The state could recharge him on two, but not on three.
What's that?
The state can recharge him on two, but not on three.
Well, I don't think they can charge him on two. He was acquitted. He was found guilty of one, acquitted of the other, and
well,
the instructions required him, the jury, to find he had a separate incident mm-hmm. on the second charge, and they said no. I mean, I don't see how he can be charged with two.
Well, there was evidence of many different incidents, and there were two submissions, and the jury found only one, so they must have found only one. There was only proof sufficient to show one incident. We don't know if they found the same incident or not.
Correct.
But you're saying they implicitly had to acquit him of everything but one.
Correct. I mean, they had to find he only touched her one time. Well, I mean, that was consistent with their trial testimony,
let's
too.
Let's assume that there would have been an improper objection or that you would have been successful on direct appeal. So it was reversed. How many charges could be refiled?
I think they can file one. My belief is, and there's case law outside the state, that they cannot double jeopardy's attached. You can't determine what he was acquitted of. They can't retry him. Anything. Now, I mean, there could be an argument made that he could be retried on one count. I think that is a debatable point, but I do think that there is...
Who would get to decide which one?
What's that?
Who would get to decide which one?
Well, I mean, that's the problem. How do we know which one count? I mean, that's why this is a problem. I mean, it's a problem. It's a unanimous verdict problem, but it also raises all sorts of profound problems with double jeopardy in terms of when the case gets sent, if a case gets sent back.
Is it conceivable that defense counsel would have seen that as a strategy? To be convicted of one as opposed to two?
No, I mean, because if he convicted of one, I mean, it goes up on appeal, and if he's convicted of one, he's convicted of one. I mean, the only, if they don't agree on it, then you get a hung jury possibly, or the jury just ultimately acquit of them all, there's various things that you could do. I mean, he was convicted of one because she said, look, at trial, she says it only happened once. She said before it happened 11 times. At trial, she says it only happens once. But there's no, the state didn't elicit specific evidence about which incident she was talking about, if any of them. And in fact, her testimony at trial with respect to the specific incidents was all, gave the jury reason to believe that none of those three incidents or types of incidents occurred, because in each case she either said, I don't remember, or it didn't happen, or there was no touching, things of that nature. You kind of gave the same where, yeah, she said she touched him once, but when you actually look at the evidence with regard to each specific incident, that it doesn't hold up. If you're just going based on her trial testimony, maybe it was an incident beyond the three that she talked about in her interviews. I mean, we don't know what this one incident was. And we don't know what the jury found the one incident to be.
Would you discuss the applicability of Celis-Garcia here?
Sure. Celis-Garcia, of course, one of the issues particularly is whether or not Celis-Garcia is somehow, a change in law, and that therefore trial counsel and appellate counsel cannot be ineffective for failing to predict what would happen with Celis-Garcia. I see Celis-Garcia, at least as it applies to the circumstances in this case, is not really breaking new ground. There are numerous decisions, particularly in the Mitchell decision out of the Southern District in the 1980s, that have addressed situations such as this where you don't have specific verdict directors in a multiple count case that differentiate between the different counts, and that was reversed. Now, the Mitchell case court did not ground its decision on the unanimous provisions of the Constitution, Missouri Constitution, but it's still reversed. There are numerous cases dating back to Washington in 1912, I believe, about disjunctive verdicts, which is analogous to the situation, although in this case the incidents weren't specified, but it's an analogous situation. The jury could find it, if he touched her in the bathroom or in the kitchen or. The fact that it's not specified in the directive doesn't matter.
Is that case applicable here when it was handed down 3 years after the Southern District's opinion? I mean, can we convict the trial counsel of error or appellate counsel of error for that matter when Celis-Garcia didn't even exist when this case was argued, even at the appellate stage?
Yes, because the instructions didn't, there's notes on use, which alerts people that, hey, this can be a It actually says, you know, this can be missing the language, but, you know, can be of decisive importance that you need to make this distinction. It can be done at defense, but also on the court's own motion. Now, it wasn't mandatory. I mean, Solis Garcia implies additional requirements about specifically informing the jury that it's a unanimous verdict, but that's not really the core of his complaint. Complaint is it doesn't even comply with the existing law. It doesn't comply with Mitchell, was a 1986 case, which is very similar. I mean, it's a weapons charge, but it's similar type of situation where he's alleged to have displayed a firearm in two different incidents, and they don't distinguish between which one, and so how do you know? It's very difficult. I mean, there are, and then the disjunctive verdict director saying there's consistent law prior to Solis Garcia that indicates that these jury instructions were erroneous.
In effect, roving commissions are never allowed. And we use that term a lot in civil cases, but you're saying instructions always have to inform the jury what they're to find the person's guilty of.
I mean, it's a roving commission. It's a disjunctive. It's in a sense, it's an implicit disjunctive verdict director because they could, even though it's not specified, they could find if, you know, again, if he committed the act in the bedroom or in the living room or in the bathroom, they can find him guilty without having to pick which one they're talking about. And again, there's also the issue about, and in this case, you know, we know that there is a reason for the jury to disbelieve at least some of the evidence. It's not like the cases where there are three incidents alleged, he's charged with all three and he's convicted of all three. I mean, we know that there's a reason to choose and say, well, some of this didn't happen. At least the jury concluded that. And so the problem is we're stuck now is there's no way to know what the jury agreed on and convicted him of.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
May I please the court?
Proceed.
The most disconcerting aspect of this case is the pleadings. If you look in the defendant's brief, it's replete with Solis Garcia citations and the right to a unanimous jury verdict in multiple acts cases. But if you look at the motion court's findings, Solis Garcia is not mentioned, and the right, the jury unanimity issue in Solis Garcia is not mentioned. So then you look to the transcript. Well, what did counsel say? Why didn't you object to these verdict directors? Well, trial counsel's never asked that question. And appellate counsel's never asked about it in the sense of jury unanimity or Solis Garcia, or probably because Solis Garcia came down 3 years after the mandate in defendant's direct appeal was decided.
Of course, that's why this is a PCR, and the question is, was the law clear that you couldn't, for purposes of double jeopardy, I mean, there's many cases, so you have to know what you're convicted of, so otherwise it raises double jeopardy implications later on, because if it's not clear what incidents you were convicted of, then you could be tried again and again and again, because you can't rule anything out since you don't know what the jury found. Those are old principles. Why did we need Solis Garcia in order to make it unreasonable for counsel not to require specificity?
I guess we could ask a defendant, then why did you need to rely so heavily on Solis Garcia in your brief to make this claim? Solis Garcia was the first case to talk about multiple acts in a child sex case of a type like this.
Can you tell me what they were convicted of in this case, what he was convicted of doing?
And what the jury was unanimous on?
Well, here's what I can tell you. First of all, the third count, the statutory sodomy, it involved the defendant having the victim touch his penis. Acquitted of that, that's out of the mix. We don't even consider that. So we have two child molestation counts, both involving the defendant touching the victim's genitals over her clothing. One count and was basically alleged that. The second count alleged a time different than the one in count one.
You're talking literally, that's what it says.
That's literally
a
what
time it, different. It doesn't say what time or give the jury any clue as to what that means.
And you're talking counts, not instructions. The instructions were identical, right?
No, the instructions were not identical.
Okay.
The first verdict director was, like I just said, the second verdict director added this fourth paragraph about that the time different than the time and this is, you know, pre-Celis Garcia.
It doesn't say it has to be the same. It's that the first one submits that he touched her, and the second one said he touched her at a different time.
At a different time.
A second time.
But
there were 11 incidents in the record that she alleged at various points, and there was one. Which times, and there were three different rooms, which times was the jury being asked to consider?
She said it happened 11 times in her interview.
Mm-hmm.
At trial, also during her interview, she said that the touching of the genitals over the clothing occurred in the bathroom and the living room. The bedroom was where the touching of the defendant's penis occurred, and that count, what he was acquitted of, so the bedroom was not ever mentioned by her as a location where the touching of her genitals occurred.
Are you saying these were proper instructions? I mean, because that's what your argument sounds like, that these were valid instructions, as opposed to they may not have been valid instructions, but the law didn't alert the counsel. I think it's important whether you're saying these are proper instructions and the prosecutor's arguments were proper, or whether we acknowledge they weren't, and it's a question of preservation and ineffective assistance.
My initial thought on this was, no, these weren't proper, or they could have been differentiated better than they were. But when you get to her trial testimony, she doesn't adopt anything that she said during her CAC interview. She merely says, he touched me one time over my clothing, on my crotch, and that's it. And that's all that ever happened.
But you're saying so inherently because her testimony would support a conviction of one. Inherently, we should know that they all agreed on that one. And doesn't the law say that is not a proper instruction? The instructions have to identify what that incident is, so we don't have to speculate they all agreed on it. We know they had facts that required them to all agree on it.
Well, if this would be a direct appeal and there was an objection and the court refused to do anything about the instructions, that's one thing, and that might have been pretty clear error.
Let me ask you a question, because you seem to get a lot of questions about if this was on a direct appeal. Didn't the trial court specifically find in paragraph 21 that there was no ineffective assistance and that there was no prejudice? And in effect, this claim wasn't brought in the amended motion other than in the pro se portion.
And that's the problem. They're asking this court to address, to undo a settled conviction, address a claim that the trial counsel and the appellate counsel were so incompetent on a matter that it's very obvious from the record that none of the parties thought was an issue.
Well, isn't that always the case when you're dealing with ineffective assistance? Should we just not have such claims? Is that what you're saying?
Your Honor, it should never be the case that this court is going to decide an issue of ineffectiveness when there is no record, when there's been no allegation, when there's been no questioning of trial or appellate counsel about why didn't you object to these, or
well,
why didn't you...
Well, that's a very different issue than what...
I think it goes hand in hand with claims of ineffective assistance of counsel.
So what would be the reasonable trial strategy, and from what you're saying, allowing submission of a count not supported by any evidence, because you're saying there's only evidence of one incident, but they submitted two counts?
Well, there was evidence of more than one incident. Because
so then how do we know which ones? And I'm not understanding. I understand it's your argument, but I don't get it. So I want orally, maybe you can explain it to me better, why it could benefit defendant to allow the jury to disagree on the incidents about which they convicted him. How does that aid him? If they're confused, if you don't draw attention to the particular incidents, you're saying that somehow could help him, and I'm not...
Well, the jury's
that.
Instructed that they have to unanimously agree.
So why wouldn't you call their attention to that by saying, unless you agree on the same incident?
Well, because I don't know what the jury, if I'm defense counsel, I don't know what the jury's going to do.
Uh-huh.
I want to sow confusion, which is exactly what they were trying to do here. You can see from the cross-examination of the victim that they wanted to sow confusion. If the jury is confused, if they don't unanimously agree on a single incident, I think the more likely outcome is an acquittal rather than them throwing up their hands and saying, let's just find him guilty anyway.
But that's so, part of the trial strategy is confusion, so you don't get beyond a reasonable doubt. Is there any evidence of, did you inquire as to embedded error? I mean, once you see this instruction, you don't allege that they let it stay there because if they don't win the trial, then you got this instruction.
Well, if this was a direct appeal, we'd be talking about something completely different. But this isn't a direct appeal. This is a post-conviction case. The presumption is there was a reasonable trial strategy reason for what occurred here, unless it's shown otherwise.
So again, because I didn't get an answer, if they're confused and he's trying to create confusion as to what incident she's talking about and where it was, absolutely, I get that. So then that is his whole strategy. I don't see any reason not to call the jury's attention to that then and say, you can't convict me in either of these unless you agree on the same one. It would be counter to the strategy used at trial not to draw the jury's attention to that.
I would never, if you have a multiple acts case charging one count and let's say 11 times it happened, I would never as a defense counsel want to draw attention to the fact that this victim has alleged 11 different incidents, which would make the jury more likely where there's smoke, there must be fire, to find him guilty on at least one. Because what would happen in a situation like that is you just don't pick one. The court can give alternative verdict directors. Did it happen in Celis Garcia's example? Did it happen in the bedroom, the bathroom, the cold room, the shed?
That here would have avoided the problem, right? Because then they would have had to agree.
And that would have avoided the problem, but would have been good trial strategy, would have been reasonable trial strategy to have done that when your whole defense at trial was, it's all fabricated. This girl was so confused, according to the defense, that you can't believe anything she says, because she said outside of court to the CAC interviewer that it happened 11 times, it happened in the bathroom, and it happened in the living room. And she comes into court and she says it happened one time over the clothes, and that's it. No questions about where this occurred. The inference is it occurred at the defendant's residence, but there were no questions about where it occurred or timing of when it occurred. I don't know how you could have drafted and jury instructions in this particular case. You could have differentiated by saying bathroom or living room. That would have been one way. But she didn't identify at trial which location it was. So the jury could have got those two instructions and said to themselves, well, she said it happened one time. She didn't specify. These two instructions say bathroom and living room. Acquit him of everything, even though
right.
They believe that the act actually occurred one time in the defendant's residence.
But isn't that what the law requires? The law requires them to unanimously agree on one act in one place at one time.
Right. On this record, and on direct review, again, a different issue. On this record, they have the burden of proof to show prejudice. They have the burden of proof to show somewhere or somehow from the record that the jury actually did not unanimously agree. I believe from the record they did unanimously agree because they were told it happened one time over the clothing and they picked one time.
But that's your surmise. It's not necessarily, you don't have the jurors saying that. You just have them voting on the verdict.
Right, and we would never hear the jurors say that, and if I want to clear that up. We weren't advocating.
And how can you say that? I mean, without admitting the other count was not supported by evidence. How do you know which count they picked? You're just deciding just what Judge Seidelman said.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I think the other count, the second count was supported by evidence. The jury just didn't credit it. They acquitted him. They believed her trial testimony, which
How do you know this? Did you interview them and that's in our record?
Well, you know, we're just guessing now because they didn't put on a good enough record.
Well, we couldn't do that anyway and ask them what they believed. Obviously,
no, you can't ask them what they believe, and we're not taking a position that jurors can never be called in a post-conviction case, but you have to have some basis in the record. In Strong, for example, there was a claim that biased jurors were put on the jury. Now, you can't go ask the jury, jurors from the old case, were you biased?
So are you telling me if she had said at trial it happened twice? Then we would grant relief because we wouldn't know which one he was convicted of, but that the trial testimony is credited more than the out of court testimony, and so it must have been just once.
Well, no, I don't think you grant relief. We're just talking about prejudice right now. I don't think the court has the record to grant relief because there was an incompetent practice because Celis Garcia had not been decided. You're asking them to trial counsel and appellate counsel to predict this case that actually explained.
But there was a requirement of unanimity and of avoiding double jeopardy long before Celis Garcia. It didn't announce it was adopting some new rule of law.
Well, sure, Your Honor. The right to unanimous jury verdict has been in the Constitution for a long time.
Okay.
But as
when Celis Garcia was reversed, did it indicate how many charges would be able to be refiled since relief was granted?
No.
You mentioned that the that this point or this claim was raised in the pro se motion, but not in the amended motion. Is that correct?
There was a claim about the jury instructions, the verdict directors, and the pro se motion, but not with respect or specified to the jury unanimity issue.
Was there any claim in the amended motion on this topic?
On this topic, there was a claim that the defendant's allegation was they acquitted me of something, they convicted me of something, I can't tell which one it was, and my rights to double jeopardy are implicated, and he faulted trial counsel for not objecting to the verdict directors. We know from the record that trial counsel actually considered the verdict directors carefully because there was a discussion off the record between the trial counsel and the prosecutor about the specific instructions and the verdict directors. And after that discussion, defense counsel comes back on the record and says, okay, I'm fine with it, no objection to the verdict directors. At the post-conviction evidentiary hearing, trial counsel's not asked one question about why you didn't object to the verdict directors. Weren't you concerned about jury unanimity? In fact, after Celis Garcia, this was to show what changed Celis Garcia, or at least enlightened about multiple acts cases in these type of cases, the MAIs were modified to add an additional note on use, warning counsel about the jury unanimity issue as discussed in Celis Garcia. While there had been a note on use previously, you just can't say that counsel acted incompetently and not objecting based on that.
And what did the previous note on use say?
That sometimes
where there's multiple incidents.
Yeah, and it just talks about location. But in Celis Garcia, the court said that's not good enough.
But why wasn't that enough to indicate here that there, when she talked about lots of incidents in different places and in her interview that and they're submitting more than one count, that why wasn't that sufficient to alert counsel that they should talk about location?
And I think the defense had the obligation to ask counsel, why didn't you object? You know about this. Here's the note on use. Why didn't you object?
But I'm addressing your argument that this was surprise, that you had to identify location in Celis Garcia, but that already was part of the notes on use at that time.
Yes, but not in specific reference to jury unanimity in multiple acts cases as outlined extensively in Celis Garcia. That note on use 7 came after the...
Thank you, counsel.
Opinion. Thank you.
Thank you.
Counsel, which claim and which motion is it that we're discussing?
We're discussing claims, and it's in the post-conviction legal file, pages 29 to 31. Mr. Mallow, on his own, identified this issue extensively in 3 pages of his motion that he filed. That motion was adopted as a part of the amended motion and was included in his claim.
How was it adopted as a part of the amended motion?
The attorney that prepared the amended motion attached it as part, or incorporated it. He didn't rewrite it, but he just incorporated it as a part of the amended motion and the motion that he filed as the amended motion.
What's 2915G mean when it says the amended motion shall not incorporate by reference material contained in any previously filed motion?
Well, I believe that there's some case law, and I can't give you the citation, it's not that he incorporated it and said, like, by reference. He actually copied the pages and filed that with the motion that he signed up.
In this case, the appointed counsel attached the original motion as an attachment.
Right.
Which is interesting because apparently even at that stage, motion counsel, for whatever reason, didn't think that this claim was sufficiently good enough to put in its amended motion.
I don't know that to be the case because, I mean, like, you know, the rules provide that, hey, you know, you can just defer and not file an amended motion at all. But really what the rule says is that if they don't think it's merit, but really what the rule says is that if you think it's adequately alleged by the pro se litigant, you don't need to amend it further. And it may be that the PCR attorney didn't think it merit. I don't know.
But it may be.
But it was included in the claim. I mean,
how do we deal with the fact that the motion court made specific findings of fact and conclusions to all the things that were in the amended motion, with the exception of the stuff that was attached, and then made a general finding as to those claims that she had considered all those claims and that the counsel was not ineffective and that there was no prejudice.
As I recall, the findings of the court were actually specifically addressed the claim here with respect to trial counsel, I believe, but with respect to, well, no, I actually didn't.
Was Mr. Ward appellate counsel or trial counsel?
I'm sorry, appellate counsel. The motion court did just address, I mean, arguably the findings of the motion court were inadequate and should have been objected to, but we're beyond that.
Well, are we, or should it be remanded?
Well, I don't know. I mean, this issue has been raised here at this court for the first time. It wasn't raised in the motion court that somehow you couldn't attach pro se claims. It wasn't raised in the court.
I'm not talking about pleadings. I'm talking about the actual judgment, because the trial judge did make a finding as to all those things that were attached, and she said that it was not ineffective.
Right, and the trial judge also said with respect to appellate counsel, and in this, in the claim, it's trial and appellate counsel. The state keeps saying, well, if it's on direct appeal, it'd be different. Well, that's part of the claim, with respect to appellate counsel, the motion court said, look, the appellate attorney testified that the appellate attorney reviewed everything in the motion for a new trial and decided not to raise anything, and therefore it was strategy for not to raise those issues.
Right. Was Mr. Ward appellate counsel, or was he trial counsel?
You know, I can't recall which.
That's the counsel you're referring to that the trial judge made the specific finding to?
No, the specific finding with respect to appellate counsel, saying appellate counsel reviewed everything in the motion for a new trial and made a strategic decision not to raise those issues. And so you have to determine whether or not that finding is clearly erroneous based on the record. I also want to clear up one thing, just because I think it's just not supported by the record. There's been assertions made that the defense attorney's strategy was to claim that the CBK fabricated the allegations. It's not in the record. There's no argument, no suggestion that she lied. She did address her credibility in the sense that she's saying one thing at one time and now saying something different. To me, I don't see how that's different than Celis Garcia. I did brief Celis Garcia extensively because that's the most recent pronouncement from this court, but there are preceding cases that raise this issue and address it.
At the motion hearing, was trial counsel questioned regarding potential trial strategy or lack of trial strategy or reasonableness of trial strategy?
No. Trial counsel was not questioned on this specific issue. Appellate counsel was asked about the instructions fairly extensively, but trial counsel was not asked any questions about it.
And why then has your client not met the burden of proving that it was not reasonable trial strategy?
With respect to trial counsel, you know, I mean, it's a problem. I cited a Third Circuit case that suggests that the courts can look and see if there's any conceivable, whether or not there's any conceivable reason for a trial counsel not to have to done or not done something, and grant relief on that basis. But yes, clearly a
And what did issue. Appellate counsel say when questioned?
Appellate counsel said, look, he specifically looks at the instructions in all cases. he didn't see an issue, doesn't recall seeing an issue, which means, like, I didn't see an issue. He said that he would include it if he thought he had, you know, he would include issues about the instructions if he thought they would have merit, but not, like, he wouldn't exclude an issue that he thought was meritorious for a strategic reason. But, you know, he didn't have specific recollection about what the verdict directors in this case.